This is episode 27 of the Software Freedom Law Show for May 11th, 2010. Hi, and welcome to the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn, who will not say evil anymore, or try not to anyway.
But you will say ahoy hoy.
Of course, I always say that. But that wasn't an ethical issue or moral issue that we debated. No. We got, Karen, last week you said to people should just write in.
Last episode.
Yeah. I forget how you said it, but you told people...
Let us know.
Really strongly, more strongly than we usually do.
It's about true, and people did.
Yeah, that was what was really kind of amazing, because we got more write-in than we ever have on the show.
And Bradley, I think you responded to almost everyone, but if you haven't received a response from us, we really appreciate what you wrote in, and it's, you know, we've been ruminating on it all week or and a half since we've published the last episode.
Yeah, I think that I did write back, I think, almost to everyone. Sometimes I just wrote back on a minor point and didn't have a lot of time to respond to people's in-depth.
But we've read them all, and thank you very much, and they've influenced our thinking.
And when most basically everybody agreed with you, which is part of the story, who wrote in. I don't think anybody actually agreed with me.
Nobody wrote in to say, I too use the word evil and think it's appropriate. I was surprised by that. I thought we would get a response.
But I wasn't saying that by the end of the episode. I was saying I was convinced that evil is too confusing.
Wow.
I was saying that. At the end of the last episode, I was saying I think... So it's not surprising that nobody wrote in.
So I convinced you and our listeners.
Well, yeah. I think I was actually almost convinced before we even started the episode. But I'm convinced for different reasons.
Take away my glory.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
I'm convinced for different reasons. I'm convinced because it's clear to me that people are confused by the term. There's no other reason for that but me. It's not that I think it's wrong to say evil or that it's not appropriate in my mind to think of it as evil. But I think when I call it evil, people bring in some connotations on that word that I don't bring in. I mean, that's, I think, the conclusion at the last episode. So, and that's what pretty much everybody was saying. I've been surprised at how many people think that saying morally wrong is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be the one that you felt was okay to say, an okay way to describe it. And a lot of people wrote in to say that had the same problems that evil did.
It's interesting, yeah. I mean, I think we don't want to relive that episode last time, but I like, you know, I think morally wrong allows an opportunity to frame a discussion.
But. So that was our feedback from the last episode. Now we're going to debate yet another topic.
I can hardly wait.
Where you and I are in disagreement, and we're going to go for it.
But, yes, we are. But I just don't know if we're going to do it right away.
Yes, we are.
We are. Okay, great.
We're right into it. After this short musical break.
I can't wait.
So you want to debate me. Is that right?
I don't want to debate you. I want to have a discussion.
That's true. I'm not really prepped for a debate, I suppose.
I'm certainly not prepped
for a debate.
I need
the little index cards like you take to the debate team meets. And
we could have a little clock.
Hey, by the way, in New York, did they call... And that's not, by the way, off-topically. In New York, when you were in high school, did they call the debate team forensics?
There were some schools that called debate forensics. In our school, we didn't have anything called forensics.
But you had a debate team instead.
We had a debate team. And I know of other schools that had both a debate team and forensics, where forensics was performance-based speaking.
But at the meets, they would have both. They would have extemporaneous and debate events.
I don't know. I did not participate in the debate team, although I did appear in the debate team photograph in the yearbook.
Yeah, you told me this once.
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just needed people. So
yeah,
a little silly.
In the Mid-Atlantic region.
I did model Congress, I guess, which was separate from debate, but
is that
had
like model
elements
UN?
Of debate. Yeah.
Oh, I was coming back from what conference was I at that was in San Francisco? Collaboration Summit. And I usually stayed at a hotel near the airport the last night, and all these model UN kids were there.
That's hilarious.
It was just mobs of UN model UN kids.
That sounds like my own personal nightmare.
It wasn't that bad. Just kidding. The elevator, it was hard to get an elevator because they apparently had went into recess or something right as I was arriving. So that was hard to get an elevator. Other than that, it was fine.
That's funny.
And they all looked like high school kids. And then I realized I'm old and they were college kids.
That's funny.
So anyway, so I was asking that because we were all called forensic. So, but we're not having a debate. You don't want to have a debate.
No, I'm...
But you have a disagreement with me about...
As I said, I wasn't on the debate team.
But you have a disagreement with me about a specific issue of my advocacy positions in free software.
I think I do. We haven't talked about it in some time. But I believe that we disagree about what kind of efforts should be taken to inform people about free software and to talk to them about free software who aren't developers and who may not already be aware of the issues.
So I think those are, part of that's two different things. People not aware of the issues and people who aren't developers. So you're doing a classic debate thing where you're mixing two issues that, that actually should be discussed separately. So with regard to the primary point, which is people who have no interest in development don't want to be developers, I probably have a fundamental disagreement with most people in the free software world, even some of the hardest core free software advocates. Most of my colleagues at FSF probably don't agree with me about this. I think there are diminishing returns on advocating free software to people who have no interest, desire, inclination to program. And the reason I believe this is actually relatively simple. It's a question of how many of the four freedoms and how and to what extent will such folks be able to exercise those freedoms. Someone who's not a developer and has no interest in development really can only exercise the freedom to run and the freedom to share the program. They can give their friends...
Those are very important freedoms.
Agreed. I agree. But the funny thing is that most people have those freedoms de facto with a lot of proprietary software anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't read the licensing agreement. They don't even know what they're not prohibited to do. It doesn't get enforced.
Well, they don't have those freedoms.
I said de facto.
And sometimes they are enforced unexpectedly from the user's perspective.
Right, from the BSA or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, the freedom to share question. But even if you say those they don't have those freedoms, the freedom to modify doesn't really change their lives all that much in a direct way. It changes it in an indirect way because over time, their ability to get their software repaired is increased and so forth. And I've always argued that, well, you can hire anybody you want in the free market if it's free software to improve your software.
I do also think that more and more people are interacting more thoroughly with their software. So I think that even a lot of people who aren't developers are at least more interested in configuration files. They're more interested because the number of people who are interacting with software has gone up exponentially, and the ways in which they do so is so varied that I think whereas when I spoke to my mother about her cell phone, you know, 5 years ago, explaining that there was software on it, she didn't really understand. But now she's very aware that there's software on her phone, there's software on her ebook, and she wants to know what she can do to make it better for herself. And I think that that is a cultural shift that we've had because of the way that we, you know, that we use software and see software in our products.
That could be true, and I may be falling...
I derailed you a little bit, I'm sorry. You can go back
I may
to...
be falling victim to the belief that I've studied this question a long time ago, and now I have a view I formed and there's new facts. But from what I saw, it was very difficult to get people interested in these issues if they didn't program. And your argument is actually very similar to one that RMS makes about convincing people to adopt free software, saying that the secretaries at MIT, when they were given Emacs, they learned a little bit of Lisp programming to make their jobs easier, and that this was an example of that anybody could learn how to program kind of thing. I would tend to think that the type of person who ends up being a secretary at MIT is a very, very unique type of secretary because they're in an academic environment and so forth. So I think it's difficult.
I mentioned my mother, she would not want to configure her own software, really, when we're totally honest. She would want my father to or me to, but she wants someone she knows to be able to configure it. And she sees an added... festival.
I haven't done that in a long time.
She sees an added value to being able to configure her software. And she thinks of that as a real possibility and a real component to what she owns and how she uses it, even though she's not actually the one. It's sort of, in her realm, it's the same idea as who's going to, you know... program the VCR.
Yeah, there's another argument I have, though, that's unrelated to this one, since I'm sort of losing this one. When I spoke about diminishing returns, I realized at one point that if I convinced every developer in the world to never write proprietary software again, that free software wins. Because if everyone insists that they get a job writing free software, and basically as a block, we boycott the writing of proprietary software as developers, the free software movement succeeded. We're done. Totally done.
I can't disagree with that, but I just think that when you talk about diminishing returns, it's very difficult to get a group of developers to solely work on free software. I think that because the proportion of free software is ever increasing, or seems to be ever increasing, I think that more and more developers are exposed to it. And once you've been exposed to free software and you are used to having those freedoms, it becomes a lot better as an experience to work with free software. So I think it is attractive. And I know that a lot of people who are, a lot of companies have cited recruitment advantage and being able to say, you know, if you come to work for my company, you'll work on free software. That's something that that talented developers find very appealing. But I think that the world where every developer is convinced is just so far removed from where we are now that it's unrealistic. It's as unrealistic to have that goal as it is to convince every consumer that they don't want to buy any products without free software in it.
Okay, so you said talented developers. Yeah, if we could just convince the talented developers, because if the only people willing to write proprietary software are people who aren't very good.
And there are talented developers who will not be convinced as well.
Probably true, but I mean, I also see this as a 250-year task, not a task that I can complete in my lifetime. So the question is, how do we get there in the long term? So I look towards things like educating children as being much more important than educating non-programming adults, because you don't actually know which children are going to be programmers. So you need to educate all children to be programmers for as long as they'll listen. And some of them will just refuse to do it anymore, and then you have to stop teaching them. But the ones who want to keep doing it will continue to be programmers. So things like the Sugar Project, which is designing software that's for young children to be able to introduce them to the computer and to programming, mm-hmm. is really important, because I want every kid to have the potential to become a programmer.
Yeah, and that
and
we
become
totally,
a free software programmer.
I mean, that we 100% agree. Actually, we agree on most things, but that, you know, that we both absolutely agree on. Like, I think that what you're missing about that is that if you don't get parental involvement in the, you know, with what those kids are doing, then that's tough too.
Oh, but that's easy because things like Sugar are going to just hand it to them, right? Mm-hmm. That part's easy because the parents won't care if there's this system there that's teaching their kids how to use a computer, and they won't care whether it's free software or proprietary software. They just want it to exist. And most parents want their kids to learn.
I mean, I agree with you.
Forth.
Look, you know, I have
to
say that when I was a kid, you know, and I had, you know, I was given systems for which I could write software for and for which I could see a lot of the software that was on them. That had a major influence on me when I was growing up. And I think that people of our generation, you know, maybe a little older in our world, but you know, have that, because, you know, reviewing code, seeing what the way our games were written, for example, made a big difference. So I agree with you about teaching kids. I mean, I think that's something that we wholly agree on.
Yeah, speaking of games, it's interesting because the I'm reminded of something that actually Andy Hertzfeld said, who worked originally with Wozniak on the early Apple. He actually argues that the various portions of the Apple II were basically free software, mainly because it was all written by hand in 6802 Motorola assembler. So it wasn't actually possible to ship proprietary code, because you had to give the source code, because the program and the binary and the source code were the same, effectively. Mm-hmm. So there is that element. That's a bit of a side point, but there is that
it
element.
It is a side point. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's, well, no, I wanted to explore it, because that is true, that that systems today are not as accessible to children, and that's why we need that. So we're in agreement about that. So the question really comes down to non-programming adults.
Yeah, I wanted to get back to that actually, because you know, you were talking about what, you know, what, which of the freedoms would non-programming adults use, and you know, whether or not, and you were saying maybe they have the de facto have those freedoms because licenses are not enforced, proprietary licenses, and et cetera. But I think that there is, in fact, a real fear component to proprietary software that I think a lot of non-programming adults really respond to. There's this fear that they're going to get caught doing something wrong, in part because of the RIAA lawsuits, and that's translated from music to software. And I know this because on almost every single plane ride that I take, I talk to the person next to me, and they invariably ask me what I do, and that's my lead-in, and I tell them all about free and open source software, what it is, why I care about it, why it's important. And it always comes down to them saying, well, I don't understand, what is this that you're talking about? Is this, you know, freeware or is shareware? You know, what are you talking about? And I just pull out my computer every time, and I show them some of the applications I'm using and talk to them about what it means that they are free as in freedom. And every time they say, you mean it's okay for me to give it to somebody else? You mean it's okay for me to use it in this way? I say, yes. The developers who have written this software have given it to you under a license that explicitly encourages you to do that. So, you know, and the response to that is amazing, because I think there is this fear. And I think that I've been talking to you in the past about how I've perceived this, that there's this cool surrounding free and open source software, and that maybe that we can take advantage of this cool to explain to people why this, you know, the ideological components of free software are valuable. But I think actually, now that I think about it right now, that cool is connected to this fear that we've been saddled with, and the idea that it's permissible to share software and to, you know, and that it's configurable and that you can use it for whatever you want to is very exciting for people, even who aren't developers.
I do agree that the using the freedom to share argument and the classic way that Stallman always organized this, and I like to organize it this way as well, is to say that proprietary licenses force you to choose between being a good person and obeying the license. You either have to help your friend out and give them a copy of the program when mm-hmm. they need a copy of the program because it's so easy to do, or you have to obey the license. And free software removes that cognitive dissonance that you always feel when someone asks you for a copy of your software on your computer. You never have to make the choice between being a good friend and being an obeyer of a license. And I think that argument is valuable to make, but again, it's a freedom to share argument that you're making. And I don't think that people are necessarily going to come to it just because they're excited about it. So the reaction you're describing you get is the kinds of, okay, so first of all, I should say I never talk to anybody on planes. I don't know why people do. I'm amazed. We are very different people, but the odds that you end up talking to somebody you don't want to for 5 hours are too great that I never start a conversation. Therefore, I never take the chance that I end up unable to do any free software work because somebody keeps talking to me.
I've never found myself trapped in a conversation for more than a half hour.
That's way too long. Do you know how much GPL enforcement I can get done in a half an hour?
And I'm trying to think of, I know that that's the case. I can't think of any situation where I've been trapped in a half hour. So.
But what I do sometimes overhear conversations, and mm-hmm. the kind of reaction they're having to you is the same kind of reaction I hear to someone who is a scientist working on an interesting science problem. It doesn't mean they're going to become a supporter of that scientist's work.
But many times after the flight, they email me and ask me for the names and links to the software that I've been describing to them.
Many times?
Yeah, actually, more than a handful for sure.
How many is a handful?
More. Well, I was thinking more than a finger, like more than five times. And it's not
less than 10?
I don't always talk to people on planes, and sometimes when I do, actually it's rare that free software doesn't come up, but occasionally it doesn't come up. And you know, recently I've been flying with people I know, and therefore, you know, then you really don't talk about.
So I should be clear that I don't think it's, to refer to last episode, morally wrong to do this kind of advocacy. I actually think it's probably morally correct, in fact. my objection is not a moral one, it's a prioritization one. From my point of view, while it's useful to convince people that free software is good, it's always useful to do that, in my view, as a free software advocate. The question is, where do we get the most benefit from advocacy? And that's a question I don't know that either of us knows the answer to.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And, you know, it might be that your guess is as good as mine. And the truth is that not everybody can work on everything. So you have to choose what you find enjoyable or what you find to be the most important thing to work on and to focus on those things. And if you're filling your time with accomplishing, you know, these tasks, then, you know, you can't fight every cause. So even within the world of free software, we can't fill every role. We can't individually try to do everything ourselves. So, you know, in that, to that extent, you're, you know, I totally agree with you.
And the self-examination question here that I can report is that one of the reasons I have this position, and I readily admit, is that I'm not particularly good at talking to people who aren't programmers. That's just a fact. People who don't have a technical mindset, they are not the people that I reach most easily when I communicate to someone. So I prefer to talk to the people that I can be most effective convincing, and I know how to talk to a programmer because I am one.
I think the problem with that is that then that sort of, and I haven't really formed this, so bear with me, but I think that sort of focuses on one kind of developer, and that's maybe sometimes some of the problems that we have, is that it winds up excluding people who might become developers who are from a slightly different set of people. But
I don't think adults randomly become developers. I guess that's a place of fundamental disagreement. I don't believe that adults randomly become developers. I don't believe that I'm missing potential developers by talking to adults.
I disagree with you, maybe because I know some adults who have at least dabbled in programming as adults. And certainly in terms of, you know, of software configuration and documentation and things like that. And I think that I think we all agree that we want to encourage a wide variety of people to get involved in our field so that we, you know, for a whole host of reasons, including the fact that it produces much better, you know, documentation, design, you know.
Yeah, I spoke too narrowly when I said developers. I meant generally people who are likely to be into technology and want to contribute to technology. That includes documentation people who like to write documentation, people who like to study software in some way and do something with it or about it. There's just two types of computer users, right? We know some that we've met, right? There's the computer user the computer user like me who cannot stand to have a bug in front of them that they can't find. I have to resist the urge. I was chasing a bug in org mode yesterday, believe it or not, because I couldn't resist the urge. I had work to do, but there was clearly a bug and I needed to find it. I mean, there's that type of person, right? So the person who is driven to fix bugs in software, they cannot help but mess with the software. There are people who are really interested in it, but maybe better have better time management or something like yourself, who was interested in it.
It's very flattering.
But you're interested in the concept, but you realize that you can't make a clear impact on that even if you chased it down. So because it would take you too much time. So you focus on the work that you can make a good impact on. So you're interested, but not driven in that way to have to find a bug. Like, I don't think you would ever get distracted by a bug and decide start loading Lisp modules to see what was going on and backtracing it. And I know you could do that. I don't think you would ever be inclined to do that just apropos of nothing, which I frequently am. So then there's that class of people, which are the type of people I talk to. Well, and then
are those the two types?
No, there's multiple. There's I
don't know if you said two types.
I might have started with two, but there's actually it's sort of a spectrum. And then you get to the people that are really interested in technology and using it. But they don't have any specific skill in improving the technology whatsoever. And they might be made into, but they're interested in hearing about it and learning about it. They like talking to programmers. They like hearing what they do. Those are the type of people that would get into things like documentation and other places where they might have specialized skills that cross orthogonally to the programming, like documentation, like artwork, like design, those sorts of things that we need help with. So there's those type of people, and I can talk to those type of people too, but that's sort of where the last group that I can talk to. Then there's people who just want their computer to do so. They want to press a button and have something happen. And those type of people, I'm not good at reaching that last class of people who are just, I just want my computer to do a job. They see it like most people see their automobiles. They get in, they turn a key, and then it goes somewhere. And they don't have any idea how the engine works. They don't care. They just see it as a nuisance if the engine doesn't work. A lot of people see their computers that way.
I think it's more nuanced than that, actually. For the same example that I was giving earlier of my mother and watching her evolution and how she thinks and interacts with her technology. Because I do think that people begin to understand what kind of role software plays in their life and that it can be configured and that there's an advantage to having software that's accessible and modifiable, at least by others that you're connected with, if not by yourself.
I have to admit, I got completely distracted there because you used the word your mother and evolution. And so I got this idea in my mind that your mother was evolving.
I can't remember.
You said watching my mother's evolution. And I got this idea in my mind that your mother is evolving, like in a science fiction thing, is evolving to one of these higher planes of existence where she's
She may very well be. She's an extraordinary woman.
Well, usually that doesn't happen in a
single person's life. She's also a major
I think your mother's
science fiction fan, actually, which is really interesting considering that she has also been afraid of technology at the same time as being a science fiction fan.
So maybe she is evolving into one of these higher beings of pure energy. So
I would not be surprised.
Like in that old Star Trek, pure energy.
So,
where Spock says pure energy. Yeah.
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, they find this being in Nisus, Captain, they're beings of pure energy. And there was a song in the 80s that sampled Spock or Nimoy saying pure energy.
Really?
Hey, speaking of Nimoy, did you hear that Nimoy is ending acting and he might end the convention circuit too?
I did hear that because you told me.
Oh yeah, you did. That's true.
And I have to say that the convention does sound very appealing.
That was out of context now. But
you said the conference.
It may turn out that this year's Creation Net Star Trek conference in Las Vegas it's the last one he's booked for.
Right.
So he hasn't announced that it's his last one.
But he sort of has indicated in the past that he was wrapping up and hadn't. So
yeah, it could be. Karen, I have and always shall be your friend.
Star Trek.
But yeah, it's Star Trek. It's important. I thought I was losing the argument, so I figured I'd talk about Star Trek instead.
That's hilarious.
Okay, well, people can write in if they disagree with me or you.
Yep.
They'll probably disagree with me. That's like
I don't know, but I've seen the excitement that the ideas behind free software can engender in people, and it's really exciting for me, and it's fun to talk about. So maybe it's because we're different people. For me, it's really fun to talk to people about the things that I care about. And if I can get them a little excited about it, it's really cool. And you sort of never know who you're going to talk to. I mean, I know lawyers that wound up playing video games and getting really into software because of that and wanting to write software because of that. I know, musicians who do the same. So not with games, but I think you never know who you're going to talk to. You never know what exciting things that people are going to do. And I think when you talk about these issues to a wider range of people, we have the ability to sway consumer-based decisions. So we didn't talk about that, actually. But in the past, just so listeners know, when we've had discussions a lot about this, I sort of point to what happened with the DRM war, and I think we're still living that. I felt for a while that we had triumphed in the face of DRM and that consumers had moved with their feet and that we wouldn't see, that even the iTunes store had to come up with the scheme of reselling their customers their music in order to come out from under their DRM approach and also turn a profit on it. But I think people began to understand that DRM was inconvenient, that it was bad, it was worse, and they wouldn't stand for it, and they were choosing to spend their money on, on DRM-free media.
Yeah, the only reason I think DRM isn't succeeding is because there are multiple companies making devices mm-hmm. that while Apple somewhat controlled the player market, and sort of still does. They don't control the desktop market, so it made it very difficult for them to force you to have all Apple equipment to do anything. Because if you had all Apple equipment, they would just implement DRM if they could ensure their customers. And they're trying. I mean, if you look at what's happening, iPhone has a ton of DRM.
Well, this is why I'm saying I think we haven't. I think we're not there yet. In part because I think the iPad is sort of all.
Yeah,
all about DRM, and it's definitely coming back. But what happened in the in the music player space was that, you know, consumers were given an option otherwise, and they chose it, and they would continue to choose it. And so, you know, I think that there's something there's a real lesson to be learned there, and I think it's one that we can learn from as well, which is that if you let consumers understand, you know, what it is that they're paying for, they may make better purchasing decisions. And there's nothing that will convince a company in the same way as their customer base.
Well, seeing how much contempt most proprietary software companies have for their user base and still get away with it, I don't see that working.
Well, it's funny.
Basically, it will decide everything goes just to the line, but not just to the line of customers leaving, but not over. It's like the Facebook terms of service thing. The terms of service of Facebook are horrible and bad for privacy, bad for software freedom, bad for everything. But it's just at the line of, I can't use the word from last week, it's just at the line of being purely evil, but not crossed it. And so it teeters
it's
on this mostly
evil. It's just what people will
evil.
Tolerate is what you're saying.
Yeah, mostly evil. And people will tolerate mostly
and
evil.
And the more you talk about it, the more you educate people, the less they'll tolerate. The less they'll be willing to accept products like that.
I see in among normal people, and I don't know very many normal people, so it's a very small subset, a small sample set. But most of those people, their attitude is simply, yeah, I hate it, but what am I going to do? What are you going to do? That's what they all say.
So even though, you know, for all of its downsides, Verizon, in marketing their Droid, did you see that commercial? I don't watch very much TV, but I saw that commercial, and it astounded me. I wish I had looked at it before. If I'd realized it would come up, I would have.
Not that one anymore.
But it was astounding to me because it actually said, like, you know, is open, is configurable, like, and it was this all these things, and it was they were marketing. Points.
Well, okay, but they're only doing that in terms of the to take it one step back from the iPhone, right? So it basically means that Apple doesn't or the vendor does not have to approve every last application you install.
But consumers know that there's something that's not quite right, and that's what Verizon was trying to hone in on. And if we can be a part of that conversation, meaning we, our community, you know, our movement. Be a part of that conversation, maybe we would see some benefits to it, because then companies entering into the space will see that there's some opportunity, that there's that customers prefer free products.
No, they don't. They don't prefer them. They prefer open source, to use Taurus's phrase, right? You look at people who use Android, they don't want to run the free firmware that Aaron and I put together. Almost everybody, lots of people we know very closely, just say, screw that. I prefer proprietary. That's what most people do.
No, I don't think so. I think that they want free software wherever possible, but to the extent that free software doesn't do what their proprietary software does, they'll choose proprietary software. So if we don't have a free driver for our phones on our, you know, on our, you know, our cameras on our phones, then people aren't willing to live without their cameras.
And if we don't have a perfect mapping, beautiful mapping application, just like Google Maps.
A mapping application that works.
That OpenStreetMaps one works? Mm-hmm. It does the essentials, the stuff you truly need to actually make the map useful. Of course, you need a proprietary library for the GPS,
which is why I don't use it. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why I don't use it either. But I think that basically, that takes away a whole segment of functionality. I think that as long as people have the functionality that they want, they will choose free and open products.
They'll choose whatever the
maybe that makes me an idealist. I am certainly an idealist, and older I get, the more idealistic I become.
People are marketed to, and unless you've spent a lot, I just discovered this. Unless you spent a lot of time really thinking about the way things are shoved at you, particularly in Western culture, in US and Europe, basically. The way products are marketed and pushed at you, unless you spend a tremendous amount of time and thought processes thinking about what's happening, you're unlikely to change.
Well, it's interesting because I think that works both ways, right? Like, I think companies, the same way that you said that they'll just be right on that line of they'll be as controlling, as closed as they possibly can be, up to the line that consumers are willing to tolerate. If consumers are willing to tolerate it, they'll go really far the other way. And what's great about that is that we have situations like the Sony rootkit, where companies really go too far and they point out. So we have this oscillation, including like
with bigger story in our community than was anywhere else. And I don't think most people heard that story.
Oh, I don't think so, because right after that, I spoke at SIGGRAPH, which was I was on a panel about DRM, which had thousands of people in it who were all from the design. I mean, or at least SIGGRAPH is a conference from the design.
SIGGRAPH's all technology people.
It's technology people, but it's not just our community by
sure
a
enough,
long
it's
shot.
All technology people. And it's the people, kind of people I'm saying we
people
can convince.
Were lining up and saying, you know, I agree with the lawyer, you know, because the Sony VP was there and saying, you know, this is ridiculous. People didn't hear all the intricacies of the rootkit, but they knew that something bad had happened. In the same way that people have the sense where, you know, the sense about the iPhone. So my friends who have an iPhone now, even people who I don't know very well will say, yes, I know my iPhone is evil, but it's so pretty. And they actually say evil. I'm not even saying the word evil, but like they say, I know that it's, you know, that I shouldn't have it, that, you know, that an iPhone is not the best choice. And consumers get a sense about this stuff. They may not know exactly why, and that's part of the reason why it's important to be part of this conversation. It's in part because of that fear that they have about sharing their software. It's
and that's what people say about junk food, and they still buy junk food, right? And, oh, it's evil that I'm eating this junk food. It's bad for my health. But they don't care. They don't really care. They don't care about the issue. I mean, I don't. I don't eat junk food because it's expensive, mostly.
I think I think they care. I mean, like, you know, not everyone will choose the banana, but if you offer banana for sale, some people will buy the banana instead of the chips.
I hate bananas. I like bananas in smoothies, but not not like to eat because they weird texture thing.
I really like bananas.
Okay.
You heard it here first.
All right, so I tried twice to take this off topic
sorry,
so that we would end it.
Sorry.
And then you brought it back on topic, which means we didn't end it. So I think we should close this discussion for
now.
All
right.
Karen, I think our Augcast is at a crossroads and we have to be.
Is it time to fess up?
Well, we have to be honest with the listeners because we want them to know that this show is for them, obviously. We're not doing this for our own benefit by any stretch.
No.
And I've gotten some feedback from at least one listener who pointed out we've occasionally repeated topics, which I do think is valuable sometimes. But we've reached a point where we've covered all the major things that we would want people to know about where legal issues and free software intersect.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you could say that there's an infinite number of interesting topics, but the truth is that we've been sort of walking a line between wanting our podcast to be accessible by everyone and also providing interesting discussion about legal issues.
Another way to put it, we've finished the course of Free Software and the Law 101.
Wow.
I think
so.
I think that our back catalog is really an audible version of Free Software and Law 101.
At least we think it probably is.
True.
Yeah.
Well, then we have this problem, especially for folks who are into something. You forget sometimes what the progression of learning that's needed to get up to speed.
And you may take it for granted that every step has been covered. Sometimes it's easy to skip a step when you're very familiar with the material.
Yeah, and this is why it's challenging to be a teacher, because you have to keep in your mind all these steps for information that you obviously already are an expert in. Otherwise, you wouldn't be teaching it, at least one would hope. I've seen this in the free software world generally. A lot of times I run into a conversation among people who I forget probably joined the free software world and sometime in 2002, 2003, and they're having some sort of discussion. And my view is, well, this was so heavily discussed and decided in the middle of the 1990s sometime. There's no new information since then. Why are people still debating this issue? And of course, the issue is new to them.
And sometimes the issues become new because there's a new perspective on them, you know, that over time, because of the way things progress, sometimes when you revisit those old discussions, you get to interesting new results.
That's one of the challenges, I think, of getting older, to make this a little more meta discussion, is that I find it tough after 15 years in the free software world to know when I'm supposed to revisit an issue and when I'm supposed to say I've already been through all the mm-hmm. details on that issue. And you run this risk of becoming curmudgeonly because you've heard it all and you don't want to hear anymore, which you can't fall into that, but you also can't have the same argument over and over again.
Yeah, it's tough because you also have to keep revisiting all discussions to be inclusive and to encourage people to become engaged. So you can't just stop having those same conversations. You can't always say, well, we had that discussion and we're, you know, we've sorted that out, when somebody new may have new ideas or may be interested in hearing that logic through. Anyway.
Well, we don't want to do either. The point is, we don't want to do either thing with our podcast.
Right.
We want to make sure that it remains accessible, but we're not against doing a more advanced episode. But we're not really sure what listeners want. And given the kinds of responsiveness we've had when we've asked for people to write in, my hope is that people will write in and tell us what kind of shows they want.
Yeah, let us know, because it's tough for us sitting here to know what it is that you want to hear more about. In some ways, covering a more advanced topic would be covering some part of the basics over again. And we've also heard some complaints from some listeners that they don't like to hear the same topics over again. So even if it's from a slightly different perspective or in a different context. So we can't please everyone, but we want to try.
Yeah, I mean, it's, of course, you cover finite automata in Computer Science 101, but then you actually do all the proofs in Theory of Computation in a 400-level course. So we don't necessarily have a problem with the progressive, advanced nature of something. And having an episode, we'll probably say ahead of time if it's particularly advanced and what episodes people might want to listen to first or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And to be fair, new basic episodes will come up over time anyway, quite naturally. We'll have a decision in Bilski. We'll have, things will come up. There will be news, and that will lead to basic podcasts. We'll have new guests. We've had a lot of really great guests. And, you know, I think we've invited a lot of the folks that we would think of first to come to our podcast, which is why they were invited first to be on our podcast. But there are other people we probably would like to interview over time.
Yeah, I think our issue with guests is we've struggled to find every last person who has some intersection in their work between free software and the law, or in many cases, free software and nonprofit administration. Mm-hmm. We went into that realm as well. But there aren't many people left. In fact, we have invited other people who haven't been able to make it for whatever reason, or just haven't been able to schedule. But we've pretty much invited. So to be clear, the class of invited people is a proper superset of the class of people that they've actually heard. but of all the people we've invited, we think we've hit everybody who has that interaction, either between nonprofits and free software and legal issues in free software. So if there's somebody we missed,
I don't want this to call out anyone who was not interested in being on our podcast or couldn't be scheduled.
Right. No, it's not in the least. Not everybody's
and
into it.
And we may have missed people too. So we may, have occurred to us.
Well, that's why I'm making this plea here, is that in hopes that if we haven't been totally inclusive in that set, you can email us names of people we ought to interview.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So if there's a topic you want to hear about, whether it's a basic one we haven't covered or a more advanced one, or if there's someone that you think would be a good interviewee, let us know.
And don't mention Bilski or patent issues in your emails, because we do have at least one episode planned as soon as the Bilski decision happens. It could be at any day between now and July.
It may have already happened by the time this episode airs.
It could have, but our plan is, once it comes out, I mean, obviously it could be a maximum of a 2-week delay, but that's our schedule and we want to stick mm-hmm. to it. Our plan is the very following episode in recording time, of after the decision's made, we'll cover that. We may even spread it to two episodes, depending on how complex the decision is and how much analysis needs to be done. So we're planning to cover that. But beyond that, we don't have a necessary plan. And the other question I think people might want to consider in writing in is how much do they want us to veer from what I sort of see as the mission statement mm-hmm. of the Ogcast, which was to cover the intersection of legal issues with free software. We could, I could easily, and yeah. Karen could as well, opine about all sorts of general free software issues.
Well, and part of the reason why this came up was because we, you know, our last episode was about use of the term evil, and we sort of realized as we, you know, got to the end of that, you know, that was also sort of outside of the scope of what we normally talk about or think about as what our podcast is focused on. And the topics that we thought about for this week were also similarly sort of off topic for the tight joining of law and free software, which is what we had originally set out to do.
Yeah, so from my point of view, if people want us to head into just covering general free software topics, I don't have an objection to doing that. There are lots of other podcasts and podcasts that do that already. And they're much more experienced podcasters than we are. And I would sort of tend to think that they're doing the job well enough. Do we really need to do it? But well, we have 3,000 people out there listening, right? That may want us to do that anyway.
On the other hand, because you're talking with me, we'll probably stay around the legal world anyway. I make everything about legal issues anyway. So.
Yeah, but I think our previous episode shows that,
yeah,
that we can get off to just general. And that was sort of a general, that was basically a discussion of free software advocacy, a question of what's the right advocacy communication policy regarding talking about the morality of free software and proprietary software. So we could do more of any of that. We could talk more generally about free software. I would be happy to talk about free software development. I just don't know if that's something our listener base is interested in. I don't really know, other than knowing that approximately 3,000 people every 2 weeks download this, and over time, 10,000, 20,000 so hits on the audio get made as the episode ages. That's all I really know. I don't know why people are listening, really. I don't know what they're getting from it. Sometimes I really don't know what they're getting from it, which I feel bad about. But we want to tailor the thing to our existing listeners. I don't think our listener base is going to grow. I think we've hit our plateau of listeners at 3,000 or
so
regular
too.
Listeners.
And thank you for listening.
Yeah, of course. but those 3,000 people, that's not a big number. It really isn't. I mean, when you compare, like Floss Weekly probably has tens of thousands of listeners.
Oh, I'm sure.
So we don't have, we have a very niche market that we can just cater it to whatever you want to hear. We're happy to talk about. It has to be related to free software, obviously. But anything within that realm, we could cater in that direction, or we could go more in depth with the legal stuff too. That's either one is possible. We just want to know what people actually want, because we've finished our formal programming.
And we're going to, you know, to be totally honest too, we're going to somewhat pick and choose because our listeners have very different opinions from each other. So we're not going to be able to make everybody happy who writes in.
We're not giving you carte blanche to program the show. We're saying that we want to begin to tailor the programming more to what people would like to hear.
Yeah.
I guess that's what we're saying.
Yeah, that'd be really helpful. So let us know.
So hopefully people understand why it is we're covering these more fringy topics. Not fringe, but not on our normal...
We're basically just covering other topics that we care about. And we'll keep doing it. But I think we'd rather know what you guys want
to
hear
and
about.
And we hope to hear from you and write in and tell us what you think we should do next and what you would like to hear next at ogcast@softwarefreedom.org.
Thanks for joining us. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
I have been and always shall be your friend.